Chapter 9 Filters. If the light sail hypothesis is true, there are two possible explanations. One is that Oumuamua's makers intentionally targeted our inner solar system. The other is that Oumuamua is a piece of space junk that happened upon us, or we upon it. Either of these interpretations could be accurate regardless of whether the civilization that created Oumuamua still exists today. But given what we know about the universe and about civilizations, we can make some inferences about which interpretation is likely correct and what implications it holds for us and for whoever, or whatever, created Oumuamua. The space junk idea is similar to the asteroid-comet hypothesis in an important way. It implies that Oumuamua is part of an incredibly huge population of similar objects. Every star in the Milky Way would have to send, on average, a quadrillion of these things into interstellar space in order to make it conceivable that one would happen to zip past our telescopes just as we trained them on the sky. That translates to one launch every 5 minutes from every planetary system in the galaxy, and it assumes that all civilizations live as long as the 13-billion-year-old Milky Way, which is certainly not the case. The idea that civilizations could manufacture their way to such a density of objects, critics argue, seems even more unreasonable than all the conjectures concerning planet formation and the release of material from outer clouds to produce a sufficient population of rocks. To fill the universe with space junk at such a density, a great many civilizations would have to spend a great deal of time ejecting a great deal of material. Of course, the moment we posit an intelligence behind some material's construction, we also do away with the need for a random distribution of materials. After all, we did not send our 5 interstellar rockets off on random trajectories. Scientists decided to send them towards certain stars, and we can anticipate that another intelligence would do the same. We should also avoid the trap of imagining interstellar spacecraft as rare and precious, as our paltry 5 interstellar probes could suggest. Given the rarity with which humanity has sent material out into interstellar space, the hypothetical abundance I have postulated would seem unreasonable indeed. This scenario seems a little less unreasonable if we think of this possibility against the potential projected rate of ejecting star chips using the Starshot initiative that my colleagues and I proposed to Yuri Milner. We estimate that once the investments have been made to build a suitably powerful laser and launch it into space, the relative costs of sending many thousands, indeed millions, of star chips into interstellar space drops exponentially. But the abundance of interstellar spacecraft in the scenario I've just described will seem most reasonable, perhaps, if we return to our plastic bottle. Right now, the United States Space Surveillance Network tracks more than 13,000 man-made objects orbiting Earth. These include everything from the International Space Station to defunct satellites, from orbital telescopes like Hubble to discarded rocket stages and even nuts and bolts left behind by astronauts. It also includes roughly 2,500 satellites it has taken us 50 years to put into space. Indeed, during that brief window of time, our efforts to send material up into our planet's orbital plane have been sufficient to make space junk a looming problem. For example, in 2009, 2 satellites, Russia's inactive Cosmos 2251 and America's active Iridium 33, collided at approximately 22,300 miles per hour above Siberia. The result was an instantaneous cloud of debris, which increased the risk of more collisions. This was the first known collision between satellites, and it underscores the danger of a rising amount of junk orbiting Earth. The threat of collision has been steadily increasing for years, in part due to ever more nations viewing space as a new frontier for conflict. Over a decade ago, China demonstrated the success of its anti-satellite missile technology by destroying its own Fengyong 1C weather satellite. India accomplished a similar feat in 2019, creating another 400 pieces, give or take, of space debris. A consequence? The risk of impact to the International Space Station was estimated to have gone up 44% over 10 days. No wonder the station is designed to maneuver out of the way of danger, assuming it has enough warning. What humans do helps us predict what other civilizations are likely to do. We continue to be our own best data set for imagining the behavior of other civilizations and the consequences of that behavior. With that in mind, consider that a computer simulation looking out 200 years predicts we will act in ways that will multiply the amount of space junk objects that are larger than about 8 inches by a factor of 1.5. And smaller junk will increase even more. The simulation predicts that the number of objects less than 4 inches will increase by a factor of somewhere between 13 and 20. This junking up of space is, sadly, in keeping with humanity's treatment of its terrestrial habitat. In 2018, the World Bank issued a report entitled What a Waste 2.0, in which it estimated that the world generated 2.01 billion tons of solid waste a year. The World Bank also projected that by 2050, that number could go as high as 3.4 billion tons. In 2017, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency estimated that the average American generates 4.51 pounds of solid waste a day, and the United States is far from the greatest producer. While the United States and China produce the most greenhouse gas emissions, it is the lower-income countries that produce the most solid waste due to their inability, driven by economics, to properly dispose of it. Of course, from the vantage point of Earth itself, the origins of the world's solid waste doesn't matter. Much of it ends up in the oceans regardless. One of the fastest-growing areas of waste is what is termed e-waste, discarded laptops, mobile phones, and home appliances that have been displaced by newer models. In 2017, the United Nations Global E-Waste Monitor estimated that in the prior year, the world had generated 44.7 million metric tons of electronic waste. And it estimated that by 2021, that would rise to 52.2 million metric tons. Here, our own civilization's behavior offers, once again, another piece of evidentiary data we can consider when we wonder about Oumuamua's origins. If we suppose Oumuamua was not a functioning probe or an inert buoy, but rather another civilization's defunct or even discarded technology, that suggests that another civilization acted in ways we can immediately identify with, that they were, like us, profligate in their production of materials, technological and otherwise, and that, like us, they were comfortable abandoning them when obsolete. Just because we have not yet reached the maturity to discard materials into interstellar space should not blind us to the possibility that our interstellar neighbors might have, or more likely, did. Trash, both in its solid waste form and its greenhouse gas emission form, is a useful analogy for a different reason. It suggests an answer to the question of how Oumuamua might have ended up roaming the universe as space junk. Because one of the insights granted by pioneering physicists in this field, men such as Frank Drake, whose famous equation quantifies our chances of detecting a light signal from an advanced civilization in space, is that most of the technological civilizations that ever existed might now be dead. Enrico Fermi was one of the giants of 20th century physics. Among his accomplishments is the development of the first nuclear reactor, and, as he was instrumental in the Manhattan Project and the production of the first nuclear bomb, he can claim some credit for the prompt ending of hostilities with Japan at the conclusion of World War II. Toward the end of his storied career, during a lunch with his colleagues, Fermi raised a simple, provocative question. How do we explain the paradox that, given the vastness of the universe, the probability of extraterrestrial life seems high, yet there is no certain evidence for anything but terrestrial life? If life is common in the universe, he asked, where is everybody? Over the years, many answers have been formulated. One is especially arresting and especially pertinent to the unfolding mystery of Oumuamua and its implications for us. In 1998, the economist Robin Hanson published an essay titled "The Great Filter: Are We Almost Past It?" Perhaps the answer to Fermi's paradox was, Hanson argued, that throughout the universe, a civilization's own technological advancement overwhelmingly predicts its destruction. The very moment when a civilization reaches our stage of technological advancement, the window where it can signal its existence to the rest of the universe and begin to send craft to other stars, is also the moment when its technological maturity becomes sufficient for its own destruction, whether through climate change or nuclear, biological, or chemical wars. Hansen's thought exercise has sufficient plausibility that humanity would do well to consider the question in his article's title: Is human civilization nearing its own filter? It would be no small irony if Fermi is the solution to his own paradox, for with Fermi's help, we developed nuclear weapons 7 decades ago. But even without nuclear weapons, we are moving to destroy ourselves by permanently changing the climate. The rise of antibiotic resistance, due to many factors, but certainly including the largely indiscriminate use of antibiotics in industrial agriculture and livestock, also poses a threat. So do pandemics, accelerated and exacerbated by our industrialized assault on our planet's ecosystem. It is quite conceivable that if we are not careful, our civilization's next few centuries will be its last. If that's the case, the emissions we've been sending out into the universe from our radios and televisions, that outward expanding bubble of noise humankind started to generate only a century ago, and the 5 interstellar craft we have already launched, could well end up the equivalent of dinosaur bones here on Earth. Evidence of something once formidable and extraordinary that is now only material for other civilizations' archaeologists. We need not look far to appreciate how the great filter might work. The small filter of our own mortality and the context of recent history provide useful data. My father's family had its roots in Germany for 7 centuries. My grandfather, Albert Loeb, fought valiantly in World War I and survived the Battle of Verdun in 1916. That one battle, the longest of the war, is estimated to have killed 143,000 German soldiers out of a total death toll of 305,000. The dead and wounded military personnel from the entire war ranges between 15 and 19 million. Add civilian casualties, and that number rises to some 40 million. My grandfather distinguished himself in the cavalry during that conflict and was awarded a medal that a decade or so later meant little. At a town gathering held in 1933 in the district of Netze-Waldeck, where my grandfather's family lived, a member of the Nazi Party loudly argued that the country's Jews were using up Germany's resources. My grandfather stood up and confronted the man. "How dare you say these words when you personally dodged the draft in the Great War as a communist while I was on the German front?" The speaker replied, "We all know about your patriotic contributions, Mr. Loeb. I was talking about the other Jews." But the rising tide of vicious anti-Semitism in Germany, and indeed in much of Europe, was discernible. It was after that public exchange that my grandfather decided to leave Germany. He threw away the medal and in 1936 emigrated to what was then British-controlled Palestine and is today Israel. Other branches of the family stayed in Germany, believing that they could wait and see what happened, holding to the belief that they would still be allowed to leave on the last trains out of Germany. Unfortunately, by then, those trains led elsewhere, and all 65 of our family members were killed in the Holocaust. I still keep Albert's pocket watch from a century ago in memory of his courage and integrity. It carries the same initials as mine, which is a reminder of sorts as well. The chain of causation that brought us here is tenuous indeed. The mystery of Oumuamua began shortly after my father died in January 2017 and unfolded as my mother's health declined. She was diagnosed with cancer in the summer of 2018 and passed away in January 2019. My father, David, was laid to rest in the same red soil in which he planted trees all his life, in the vicinity of those plantations that he watered routinely, near the house that he built with his rugged hands and that I grew up in, surrounded by the people he loved and who loved him in return, under the blue sky that I study as an astronomer. My mother, Sarah, who put me on the road to thinking as a philosopher, with whom I spoke daily throughout my adulthood, and who especially gifted me with the life of the mind, was buried beside him 2 years later. In astronomy, we realize that matter takes new forms over time. The matter we are made of was produced in the hearts of massive stars that exploded. It assembled to make the earth that nourishes plants that feed our bodies. What are we, then, if not just fleeting shapes taken by a few specks of material for a brief moment in cosmic history on the surface of one planet out of so many? We are insignificant, not just because the cosmos is so vast, but also because we ourselves are so tiny. Each of us is merely a transient structure that comes and goes, recorded in the minds of other transient structures. And that is all. The deaths of my parents brought home to me this and other fundamental truths about life. We are here for a short time, and consequently, we had better not fake our actions. Let us stay honest, authentic, and ambitious. Let our limitations, very much including the limited time we are each given, encourage humility. And let us allow the small filter, which represents the extent of our own lives, give us an approachable and sobering context for Hansen's great filter, which represents the end of our civilization. With insufficient care, diligence, and applied intelligence, humans have proven themselves all too comfortable with ending the lives of their fellow humans. Of all the lessons we can learn from Oumuamua, the most essential might be that we cannot allow the smaller filters of war and environmental degradation to grow into a great filter. We must exercise greater care, diligence, and applied intelligence in the preserving of our civilization. Only in this way can we save ourselves. During my years of military service, there was a phrase we were taught during infantry training: to lay your body on the barbed wire. Sometimes, faced with extraordinary circumstances, a soldier must deliberately lie down on barbed wire to allow his fellow soldiers to use his body to safely cross over. I am not so grandiose as to imagine my experience is the equivalent of such a soldier's sacrifice. But mindful of the specter of the great filter, and ever mindful of the shadows of those who have come before and in their turn have sacrificed to advance humanity's common cause, I find the image inspiring. Of this I am certain: the tenuous threads connecting humanity's earthbound civilization as it exists today and the promise of humanity's possible interstellar civilization as it might exist tomorrow will not be upheld by exercising conservative caution. In the words of Rebbe Nachman of Breslov, "The whole world is nothing but a very narrow bridge, and the key is not to be fearful at all." On September 1, 1939, 3 years after my prescient grandfather left Nazi Germany, Germany invaded Poland, and much of our planet found itself at war. It would be another 8 months before Winston Churchill assumed his role as the wartime Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. In the interim, Churchill relentlessly warned his country and the world of the threat posed by Adolf Hitler and a militaristic Germany. Churchill also continued one of his cherished pastimes, writing. That decade, he penned, among other things, a 4-volume biography of the first Duke of Marlborough and numerous opinion pieces and articles for newspapers and magazines. A subject of special interest was science. Churchill became the first British Prime Minister to appoint a civilian science advisor to the government, and his popular science essays touched on everything from evolution to fusion power to aliens. In 1939, as the world was collapsing around him, Churchill penned an article titled, "Are We Alone in Space?" He never published it. The confluence of events that would bring him to the apex of his political influence would also sweep this essay aside and bury it for decades. A war was fought and won before Churchill, once more out of political fashion in the United Kingdom, revisited his article. In the 1950s, he gave it the more accurate title, "Are We Alone in the Universe?" But it still sat unpublished at the time of Churchill's death, and it entered the U.S. National Churchill Museum archives unknown and uncommented upon until its discovery in 2016. It is a shame that Churchill's unusual essay was never published, for it contains ideas that were well ahead of their time and a sense of perspective that was sorely needed then as it is now. Churchill evinced the modesty of a generalist as he wondered how unique the sun and our planetary system might be, writing, "I am not sufficiently conceited to think that my sun is the only one with a family of planets." He was also astute. Decades before the discovery of exoplanets, Churchill concluded it was reasonable to believe that a large number of planets existed at the proper distance from their parent sun to maintain a suitable temperature, had both water and atmosphere, and so could potentially support life. Indeed, given the expanse of space and the number of suns in it, he wrote, "The odds are enormous that there must be immense numbers which possess planets whose circumstances would not render life impossible." And though skeptical of interstellar travel, Churchill allowed that, "in the not very distant future, it may be possible to travel to the moon, or even to Venus or Mars." The somber note in the article isn't reserved for the possibility of extraterrestrial life in the universe, or even of humanity's ability to reach other planets, but rather for humanity itself. "I, for one, am not so immensely impressed by the success we are making of our civilization here," Churchill wrote, "that I am prepared to think we are the only spot in this immense universe which contains living, thinking creatures, or that we are the highest type of mental and physical development which has ever appeared in the vast compass of space and time." When I first heard about Churchill's essay a few years ago, I couldn't help but indulge in a thought experiment. The planet-spanning war that erupted shortly after Churchill wrote his essay is estimated to have cost $1.3 trillion, the equivalent of about $18 trillion in today's currency. No reliable records exist to accurately estimate the number of people who died due to the war, and scholars bicker over which deaths can be clearly attributed to the war itself, but the range falls between 40 million and 100 million human beings. What if, in the 1940s, humanity had instead spent that $1.3 trillion, not to mention the skill, expertise, muscle, and minds of between 40 and 100 million people on the exploration of the universe? What if the era's collective genius hadn't turned itself to destruction, efforts that reached their pinnacle in the development of nuclear weaponry, but had turned instead toward sending terrestrial life into the solar system and then out into the expanse beyond. What if human civilization, out of humility and the application of the scientific method, had concluded that its own existence made the existence of other civilizations in the universe probable? What if, in 1939 and over the course of the next decade, humanity had oriented itself towards space exploration and the discovery of extraterrestrial life rather than the vast extermination of life here on Earth? If there is a multiverse, and if such a version of human civilization exists in it, I predict that at a minimum, it managed to photograph Oumuamua, maybe even capture it for thorough examination. Perhaps those humans were not even surprised by what they found, for on their version of Earth, the Breakthrough Initiative would have started decades earlier, and as a consequence, they would already be in receipt of the information that laser-powered light sail ships had captured during their passage near Proxima Centauri. They would be well on their way, surely, to contemplating a solution to ensuring life's continuation after the inevitable death of our sun. I suspect, too, that their beaches would be less littered with trash. I'm sure there is one similarity, at least, between that Earth and this one. I will bet that their historians refer to the pivotal generation, the one that in the 1940s set it all in motion, as their greatest. Alas, we reside on this Earth, collectively tasked with the preservation of our human civilization. Among all the thought experiments that the multiverse theorists give us, the most productive, I believe, is this one. What will we do as residents of the one universe immediately arrayed before us? As I write, I consider the tree visible from my living room window. Are we a civilization that will bind the damaged limb, allowing it to mend and grow? Or are we a civilization that either ignores it or shears it off, forever ending that branch of possibility? Whichever choice we make, we bet with our children's lives. If, when confronted with Oumuamua's exotic features, the only hypotheses we can contemplate are the natural but statistically remote, if we cannot, as Sherlock Holmes might, entertain the simplest remaining explanation to the collected data, we may do worse than simply delay our civilization's next leap forward. We may walk into the abyss, one civilization among many, and perhaps one not even advanced enough to have left as a calling card, buoys throughout the universe. Chapter 10. Astroarchaeology. If we conclude that civilizations wink in and out of existence, perhaps serially over the long, long history of the universe, it would be a grim warning for our own civilization. It would also be an opportunity. As scientists and as a species, we could tailor our detective work and search for the relics of dead civilizations. Even an oblique discovery of such evidence could teach us an important lesson, namely, that we need to get our act together if we're to avoid a similar fate. As I've mentioned, this could prove to be Oumuamua's profound message in a bottle, one that we're stubbornly refusing to read. Grappling with it fully, I believe, will require us to stop thinking of astronomy simply as the study of stuff in space and start treating it as an investigative and interdisciplinary enterprise. We are greatly in need of a new branch of astronomy, what I have termed space archaeology. Similar to archaeologists who dig into the ground to learn about, say, Mayan society, astronomers must start searching for technological civilizations by digging into space. It is enthralling to imagine what these astro-archaeologists might find, but that's not even the most compelling reason to take this research seriously. It could well hold insights that nudge us in new scientific and cultural directions, and perhaps make our civilization one of the rare ones to outrun the great filter. Recall that one of the biggest limitations of the Drake equation, the formula designed to help anchor discussions about intelligent extraterrestrial life, was its myopic focus on communications signals, which are only one of the various detectable traces that other civilizations might leave behind. Frank Drake defined the first variable of his equation, N, as the number of species in our galaxy that possess the technology necessary for interstellar communication. He defined the equation's final variable, L, as the duration of time such species are able to produce detectable signals. In short, his equation was bracketed by the assumption that intentional efforts to communicate were the only way in which extraterrestrial civilizations would be detectable. However, there are lots of ways in which alien civilizations might unintentionally broadcast their existence, and as we discover new technologies, the number of new avenues available to search for this evidence is increasing. How ought we to redefine the scope of our search? To put it another way, what should we be looking for, and where should we be looking? The first of these questions is, I believe, relatively easy to answer. We know that life forms of all sorts are identifiable by what we call biosignatures, for example, algae blooms and polluted atmospheres that living things leave in their environment. So, in addition to seeking traces of technologically advanced extraterrestrial life, we can search for evidence of less advanced alien life, such as microbes, whether living or long dead. Thus, the first question leads to another, more granular question. What kind of life should we be looking for, advanced or primitive? In a paper that I wrote with my postdoc, Manasvi Lingam, we estimated the likelihood of finding primitive versus intelligent extraterrestrial life using only state-of-the-art telescopes. At the time, that included the James Webb Space Telescope, the successor to the Hubble Space Telescope. At heart, this was an effort to determine what part of astroarchaeologists' efforts should be spent on the search for biosignatures and what part on the search for technosignatures. The exercise helped sharpen my thinking about the answer to the question I posed earlier: what should we be looking for? This project required us to work through a number of highly uncertain variables, including several that demanded best guess answers. For example, we had to determine how much rarer intelligent life was than microbial life, how much farther away we could detect a technosignature versus a biosignature, and how long both types of signatures would be discoverable. Our selection of variables also reflected our concern over the great filter, although we made an optimistic guess about how long the sort of extraterrestrial technological intelligence we were seeking would survive. We set it at a millennium. Optimism is a precondition for scientific work, I've found, but in this case, optimism also factored into our actual calculations. In more ways than one, the more pessimistic you are, the lower the prospect of finding intelligent life. Consider, too, that in the scenario I have just described, we needed to guess both the duration of time in which intelligence might be discoverable as well as another related variable, the period over which our intelligence would be around to seek it. With that said, it must be admitted that discovering primitive or microbial life would not be the same as discovering intelligent extraterrestrial life. Either would fundamentally alter humanity's view of itself, but evidence of technological intelligence would have the greater impact. To learn that other, perhaps even more advanced, intelligent civilizations exist or preceded us would force us to adopt a humbler attitude toward the universe and our accomplishments. Ultimately, we concluded that the likelihood of detecting intelligent life was approximately 2 orders of magnitude smaller than the likelihood of detecting primitive life. Yet we also concluded that both searches should be undertaken concurrently, if with significantly more funding dedicated to primitive life, given that we expected it to be more plentiful. Additionally, the existence of intelligent life would greatly raise the prospects of our finding microbial life, too. So, what should we be looking for? In a word, life. We should just be prepared to find one type of it sooner than the other. Where, then, should we be looking? Answering this question is trickier and more complicated, but ultimately, perhaps, more comfortably familiar, because it requires us to start with terrestrial abiogenesis, the origin of life on our planet. The field of origins of life research is nascent. While we know a great deal about one aspect, terrestrial abiogenesis, our knowledge is an island in a vast ocean of ignorance. Yet there are reasons to be cautiously optimistic about where it is headed. As I write these words, we are far closer to understanding how the first cells, the building blocks of life, obtained replication and metabolic functions, and we are far closer to explaining how the precursors of biomolecules, such as proteins and carbohydrates, were synthesized and assembled from a common starting point. And while we do not know if extraterrestrial life would rely on the same building blocks that gave rise to life on Earth, we are becoming better equipped to think about the frequency of abiogenesis elsewhere as we approach an understanding of how life arose here. In the quest to find extraterrestrial life, no question is more important than whether life is broadly deterministic and quite probable, or a consequence of random and improbable events. In other words, do the same basic conditions always give rise to life? Or was the emergence of life on Earth a freak occurrence that is very unlikely to happen again? Numerous fields of study are advancing these questions on all fronts. As they do, one simple observation looms large. The single substantial source of data we have, namely Earth, is astoundingly fecund. The factors that allowed life to emerge on Earth, crucial among them our planet's distance from the Sun, didn't result in merely a few microorganisms huddled around hydrothermal vents on ocean floors. They produced a cornucopia of life of such rich complexity that today's flora and fauna rest atop an entire era of reptiles that preceded them. For us to believe that teeming life would be restricted to a single blue marble in the entire expanse of the universe seems the very height of hubris. Nearly all life on Earth is dependent on the sun. Not for nothing have humans worshipped it from the dawn of our civilization to the last time you spent an hour lounging on a beach towel. We are literally the stuff of stars. The matter we are made of was produced in the hearts of exploding stars, which then formed planets like the Earth, which then became the material of all terrestrial life, including you and me. And without the warmth and light of the sun, there would be no plants, no abundant oxygen, no life as we know it. It is no exaggeration to state the majority of complex multicellular life on Earth is directly or indirectly dependent on the sun's existence. But what should the search for extraterrestrial life take from this fact? How can we use the known certainty that the sun supports conscious intellectual life to inform our search for life elsewhere? Knowing whether or not our sun is anomalous would tell us a good bit about how anomalous or not the life that it supports is. If the sun is a typical host in all respects, and the presence of sentient life in its vicinity is exceptionally rare, if not unique, then our existence is most likely the result of random chance and unusual indeed. But if the sun is atypical in certain respects, perhaps those atypical characteristics are required for life, making our existence less random and less unique. That, in turn, would make our search for extraterrestrial life less random, for we would have reasons to examine stars like our own. As it happens, the Sun-Earth system is anomalous in two clear respects. First, the Sun's mass, 330,000 times that of Earth, makes it more massive than 95% of all known stars. And while this does not rule out our interest in searching for life on planets orbiting more statistically average stars, given that we have limited resources of time and money, it encourages us to look for stars that are especially massive, like the one that sustains us. The qualities of the Sun encourage us to direct our search for extraterrestrial life, at least initially, to stars that are similar to our own. The qualities of Earth guide our search as well, particularly when it comes to picking which planets to study first. The observable data from Earth, the one planet that we know supports a dense and complex biosphere, allows us to compose a short list of features we should look for on other planets. But paramount among all the parameters that are essential for Earth's habitability is the existence of liquid water. Liquid water, often called the universal solvent, is ideally suited to transport energy into and waste out of cells. And no terrestrial life has been discovered that is able to exist without it. It is so important for life, in fact, that astronomers use it to define the habitable zone around each star, measured by a planet's orbital distance from the center of the solar system. Identifying planets at the Goldilocks distance from a star, that zone in which water neither freezes nor evaporates, is the astroarchaeologist's starting point in the hunt for alien civilizations. The universe, it turns out, provides us with an embarrassment of places in which to look. Over the past two decades, we have learned that the universe contains numerous exoplanets, the technical term for any planet residing outside the solar system. This spate of discoveries began in 1995, when astronomers Michel Mayor and Didier Queloz became the first to find definitive observational evidence for an exoplanet, a close-in Jupiter-like planet, 51 Pegasi b, around a sun-like star, based on the line-of-sight motion of this star as the exoplanet orbited it. Their pioneering work ushered in the new era of hunting exoplanets and earned them a Nobel Prize in 2019. The basic contours of this research were not, in fact, new. They had been put forth four decades earlier by the astronomer Otto Struve, who proposed that the hunt for alien planets might profitably target gas giants zipping around their parent stars in tight orbits, big worlds going around their stars within a few Earth days. The existence of such planets, Struve argued in a 1952 paper, was suggested by the evidence that some binary stars, a pair of stars bound together by gravity, whip around their common center of mass in a similar manner. And these big exoplanets should be relatively easy to detect via their powerful gravitational tugs on their host star or their blocking of light during transits across the star's face. But Struve's paper was ignored, as was his proposal to search for close-in Jupiters. The scholars that sat on the time allocation committees for major telescopes asserted that it was commonly understood why Jupiter lies as far from the Sun as it does, and they saw no reason to waste telescope time in searching for exo-Jupiters that were much closer to their host star. Their prejudice slowed down scientific progress by decades. Once exoplanets were legitimized as part of the mainstream, their discovery accelerated rapidly. Within a decade after the discovery of 51 Pegasi b, hundreds of other exoplanets were identified. And with the 2009 launch of NASA's Kepler Space Telescope, built for the explicit purpose of identifying exoplanets, that number, at the time of this writing, has jumped to 4,284, and thousands of candidates await confirmation. What is more, we now know that about a quarter of all stars are orbited by planets of Earth's size and surface temperature, planets that might have liquid water, and the building blocks of the chemistry of life on their surfaces. The abundance of exoplanets upon which we could fix our observational equipment reminds me of a common Jewish tradition during Passover Seder, the hiding of a piece of matzah called the afikoman. The task for the children of the household is to find it, and whoever is successful receives a reward. What I learned as a child, and what I am mindful of now as an adult in the nascent field of astroarchaeology, is that the question, where to look, trumps the question, what exactly are we looking for? And my sisters and I also quickly learned that the best places to start looking were the places where the Afikoman had been hidden in the past. Today, this same strategy is guiding the search for extraterrestrial life. Most of our telescopes and observational instruments are seeking evidence of life on rocky planets with features, most crucially liquid water, that are consistent with the one place we know life exists, Earth. But is this all we can do? Is there anywhere else we might look, even if we restrict ourselves to the orbits of alien stars? Exoplanets that seem similar to Earth aren't the only places where we could seek life. Additional research that I conducted with my postdoc, Manasvi Lingam, suggests another highly promising place to seek the chemistry of life, in the atmosphere of so-called brown dwarf stars. Brown dwarfs are small, less than 7% of the mass of our sun. And since they do not have enough mass to sustain the nuclear reactions that cause other stars to burn so bright and so hot, they can cool to planetary temperatures. This could result in liquid water existing on the surfaces of small, solid particles in the clouds orbiting a brown dwarf. We needn't stop with brown dwarfs. We should also consider examining green dwarfs, dwarf stars that show the telltale red edge in reflected light that is evidence of photosynthesizing plants. By our calculations, green dwarfs orbiting sun-like stars might be our best bet for locating an astrobiological Afikoman. Green dwarfs, brown dwarfs, and exoplanets in the habitable zone of suns. These options in no way exhaust the possibilities for astroarchaeologists, especially when you posit civilizations far more technologically advanced than our own. But at this stage of the search for extraterrestrial life, when our theorizing, observational tools, and efforts at exploration are in their relative infancy, these are the best targets available to us. Outside of our own solar system, that is. Even as we contemplate seeking out life in interstellar space, we must admit that we've not exhausted the possibilities within our own solar system. Astroarchaeologists should also seek evidence of extraterrestrial life in our planetary backyard. We could start by looking for technological equipment floating through the solar system. Much as we spotted Oumuamua, we might discover and obtain conclusive evidence about other artificial objects that originated from other stars. In the first century of our own technological revolution, we sent Voyager 1 and 2 out of the solar system. Who knows how many more such objects an advanced civilization might have launched? The simplest way to detect passing alien technology is to search under the nearest, largest, brightest lamppost, the sun. Just as happened with Oumuamua, sunlight provides us with valuable information about objects' shape and motion, and it also makes them more visible. We need all the help we can get in this search because, for the moment, our tools for spotting objects like Oumuamua are relatively primitive. As I explained toward the beginning of this book, the telescopes that discovered Oumuamua did so accidentally. They were all designed, built, and deployed to accomplish other things. The earliest space archaeologists will likewise have to repurpose existing astronomical tools, at least until such time as the world provides them with instruments explicitly built to their purposes. In the meantime, perhaps the easiest way for us to look for alien technology in our solar system, and certainly the best opportunity we will have to actually lay hands on it, is to devise a method to detect it as it collides with the Earth. This would require us to find a way to use the Earth's atmosphere to search for artificial meteors. If the object is bigger than a few meters, it could leave behind a remnant meteorite that, if we could detect it and track it, might yield the first tangible evidence of extraterrestrial technology. We can also search the surfaces of the Moon and Mars for extraterrestrial technological debris. Whether we liken the Moon, which has no atmosphere or geological activity, to a museum, a mailbox, or a dumpster, we can say one thing for sure. It keeps a record of all objects that crashed onto its surface over the past billions of years. Without checking, however, we will never know if it contains the equivalent of a statue, a letter, trash, or nothing. We needn't restrict ourselves to planet surfaces. Jupiter, for example, could serve as a gravitational fishing net that traps interstellar objects that pass near it. Given scientists' current blinders regarding what's out there, they assume they'll recover only natural rocks or icy bodies like asteroids and comets, and no doubt that is the majority of what we would encounter. But perhaps it is not all we would encounter. Given the rich reward of such a find, we should make the effort. Yes, it will be vastly more expensive and vastly less certain than low-key surveys, but such an undertaking would be in the same vein as my family walking along a beach examining shells. Perhaps tomorrow's space archaeologists will find the equivalent of an extraterrestrial civilization's plastic bottle. The more tools we arm tomorrow's archaeologists with, the farther they can extend their search. As I postulated in collaboration with Ed Turner, from the outskirts of our solar system, one can look for artificial lights that originate from distant cities, or perhaps giant spacecraft. One can distinguish an artificial source of light from an object reflecting sunlight by the way it dims as it recedes from us. A source that produces its own light, like a light bulb, dims inversely with distance squared, whereas a distant object that reflects sunlight dims inversely with distance to the fourth power. One such tool that space archaeologists could use to great effect is the advanced instrumentation at the Vera C. Rubin Observatory. This wide-field reflecting telescope is expected to commence its survey of the sky in 2022. Along with mapping the Milky Way and measuring weak gravitational lensing to give possible insights into dark energy and dark matter, it is expected to increase humanity's catalog of objects in the solar system by a factor of 10 to 100. The Vera C. Rubin Observatory is far more sensitive than any other survey telescope, including Pan-STARRS, which, of course, discovered Oumuamua. With our newfound ability to peer farther beyond the solar system than ever before, we could search for artificial light or heat redistribution on the surface of a planet. Breaking out of the constraints of the Drake equation, we could look for technosignatures beyond just communication signals. To see how this might work, consider an exoplanet that is already in our sights. The tidally locked planet Proxima b orbits the habitable zone of Proxima Centauri, the star nearest to our sun. When my colleagues and I worked on the Starshot initiative, Proxima b was the exoplanet we identified as a possible target for our light sails. Though Earth size, the rocky Proxima b always faces its star with the same side. You may recall that my younger daughter pointed out that it would make sense to own two houses on such a planet, one on the permanent day side where it is always hot and bright, and another on the permanent night side where it is always cold and dark. But an advanced civilization might find a solution of greater technological sophistication. As I argued in a paper with Manasvi Lingam, the planet's inhabitants could cover the dayside surface with photovoltaic cells that would generate sufficient electricity to illuminate and warm the night side. Were we to focus our instruments on such a planet, the varying level of light from its surface as it moves around its star could tell us if a global engineering project of this type had taken place, and the solar cells on the day side would also produce distinctive reflectance and color. Studies to seek out either phenomenon can be done just by monitoring the planet's light and color as it orbits its host star. This is just one example of the range of telltale signals that space archaeologists could train their instruments to seek. As our own planet suggests, they could look for evidence of industrial pollution in distant atmospheres. Indeed, several years before Oumuamua appeared in our solar system, I wrote a paper with my undergraduate student Henry Lin and the atmospheric expert Gonzalo Gonzalez about searching for industrial pollution in the atmospheres of exoplanets as a signature for advanced civilizations. And while the atmosphere's contamination by a blanket of pollutants could signal one civilization's failure to outrun the filter, it could signal a different civilization's efforts to intentionally warm up a planet that was otherwise too cold, or cool down a planet that was deemed too hot. Astro-archaeological excavations conducted light years away from their objects of study could also include a search for artificial molecules, such as chlorofluorocarbons, CFCs. Long after a civilization has expired and so ceased to send out deliberate signals, some molecules and surface effects of industrial civilization will still survive. The sandbox of space archaeology stretches, of course, to the edge of the universe. There is no reason to confine our searches to planets. With that understanding, some scientists could dedicate their efforts to searching for flashes of light from beams sweeping across the sky from great distances. Such beams might indicate a civilization's means of communication or a means of propulsion. When humanity has taken the necessary steps to send light sail craft out into the universe using the method my team devised for the Starshot initiative, such technology will result in bright flashes visible to others due to the inevitable leakage of light over the edge of the sails. In addition, one could search for a swarm of satellites or megastructures that block a significant fraction of the light from distant stars, a hypothetical system known as a Dyson sphere, after Freeman Dyson, the late great astrophysicist who first envisioned it. Such gigantic megastructures would confront major engineering challenges, and if they exist, they would be rarities. But they also present a possible technological solution to the great filter, and given foresight, means, and opportunity, a civilization facing its own extinction could set out to overcome those challenges. Finding out if such things exist, however, begins with our seeking evidence of them. The contemplation of such megastructures raises a recurring question that space archaeologists will have to overcome, given that their efforts must presuppose the existence of intelligences greater than their own. That a project like a Dyson sphere strikes humans as overwhelming, indeed impossible, may simply reflect the fact that we are not yet intelligent enough to undertake it. A civilization far more advanced than our own may well have overcome the hurdles that we, from our more limited understanding, see as insurmountable. Pursued to its fullest extent, astroarchaeology would inevitably be humbling. But this is the aspect of it that could yield the richest rewards. If we can accept that we are very likely less advanced than civilizations that have come before us, this might well lead to our finding ways to speed up our own plodding evolution, a psychological transformation that might allow humanity to leap forward by thousands, millions, or even billions of years. Evidence is omnipresent for the real probability that humanity has not set the intelligence bar particularly high and that other civilizations have likely cleared it. It is as close as your newspaper, your nearest screen, and your endlessly refreshing newsfeed. The true marker of intelligence is the promotion of one's own well-being, but too often our behavior does the opposite. I have found that paying close attention to the world's most pressing news stories provides ample evidence that we cannot be the smartest species out there. humanity has rarely focused on its collective well-being, not over the preceding centuries and not today. Among our current bad habits, we repeatedly opt for short-term benefits over long-term benefits in matters as complex as carbon-neutral energy, as fraught as vaccines, and as obvious as shopping with reusable bags. And for over a century, we have been broadcasting our existence to the entire Milky Way in radio waves without pausing to worry if any other civilizations out there might be both smarter than us and more predatory. Of course, the coordination of effort required to present the universe with a more nuanced, uniform message from human civilization presupposes a civilization capable of unity. Human history gives scant reason to hope for that in the future, at least in the near term. For the budding field of space archaeology, another foundational challenge, besides getting the requisite tools and resources, will be adopting approaches that increase our ability to imagine the products of other, more advanced civilizations. To put it another way, we must not let the limitations of our own experience and our resulting presumptions leave us intellectually unprepared to interpret any defunct, discarded, or deliberately sent extraterrestrial technology. To make the point to my students that we cannot allow the familiar to define what we might discover, I have often used the analogy of cave dwellers discovering a modern cell phone. It aptly applies to the possibility that soon humanity may discover a piece of advanced technological equipment developed by an extraterrestrial intelligence. If we do not prepare ourselves, if we have not allowed for the science of space archaeology, we could act much as these cave dwellers would, imagining the phone to be nothing more than an exotic, shiny rock. And with that short-sightedness, those dwellers would miss the chance to take that million-year leap forward. One fact is clear. If we assign a zero probability for finding evidence of artificial objects, as some scientists did in the case of Oumuamua, if human civilization organizes its efforts and its funding and its scholars by declaring, "It's never aliens," then we guarantee that we will never find evidence of extraterrestrial civilizations. To move forward, we must think outside of the box and avoid prejudice about what we expect to find based on past experience. As individuals and as a civilization, we also must learn modesty regarding both our potential place in the universe and our potential future in the universe. It is far more statistically likely that we are at the center of the bell curve in universal intelligence than that we define the outer edge of the most intelligent. Students in my class are often surprised to hear the trivial but sobering remark, "Only half of you are better than the median of this class." The same applies to civilizations. That we have discovered many planets similar to Earth and have to date found no conclusive evidence of other civilizations should not lead us to presume our civilization and terrestrial life is uniquely assured of a bright future. While historians can quibble over whether or not our past suggests a teleological direction toward progress, the universe offers a clear answer. The history of the universe indicates a trend toward extinction of stars, of planets, of solar systems, and perhaps of the universe as we know it. The search for, let alone the discovery of, extraterrestrial technology could jar us from our more limited frame, our habit of looking forward a generation or two, and not with the future of our civilization uppermost in mind. Let me illustrate the need for a new mindset with a personal anecdote. I made 6 visits to the same university town in Europe, and my hosts kept putting me in a small hotel room where I would bump my head against the tilted ceiling while taking a shower, and had to crawl into my narrow bed without space to stretch my legs. I decided I had had enough. Next time, I promised myself, I will reserve a double room. And so I did. But when I arrived at the hotel on my next trip, the receptionist said, "I see that your wife could not make it. I will be glad to downgrade your room reservation to a single room." I said, "No way. Please put me in the double room that I reserved." When I mentioned the story to my hosts and asked why space was so limited in this town, they answered, "Because the town has a rule that no building can be taller than the church." This raised my inevitable question, "Why don't you make the church taller?" To which they replied, "Because it has been like that for centuries." Inertia is a powerful thing. Young people often imagine new worlds, literally and metaphorically, but their revolutionary ideas are frequently met with skepticism and dismissal by the adults in the room, who lost their enthusiasm for challenging reality in many bruising fights long ago. The adults simply got used to things the way they were. They came to accept what was known and to ignore the unknown. Youth is a matter not of biological age, but of attitude. It is what makes one person willing to open up new frontiers of scientific discovery while others try to stay within the traditional borders. Becoming a scientist offers the great privilege of maintaining our childhood curiosity and questioning unjustified notions. But this opportunity does nothing for anyone unless people seize it. It is commonly believed in the conservative scientific community that intelligent life is probably unique to Earth, and that it would be a waste of time and funds to search for artificial signals in the sky or for the debris of dead civilizations in outer space. But this is an ossified way of thinking. Today's new generation of researchers has access to telescopes that could turn this notion on its head. Just as Copernicus revolutionized the prevailing dogma about our place in the universe, our generation can foster a new revolution by making the church taller still.